Hello, my name is Tony Reid. Welcome to GAY, a radio programme for LGBTI people and their friends on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM and other access radio stations around New Zealand. 3 years ago, there were loads of new LGBT MPs arriving, all green, or I think all green or Labour, but I don't think gay people exist in National or ACT. And we had a particularly nice experience interviewing one new MP, Ricardo Menendez March. And so I thought now that it's 3 years later and he's had lots of experience and become far more well recognised, I think, as well, that I would interview him again. And he seemed happy to be interviewed, so here we are. Welcome, Ricardo. Nice to talk to you.
Good, Tony. Likewise. Good to be here.
Yes. I suppose I could really start off by asking you just to summarise what the last few years have been like for you and where you have ended up specialising, etc., and how you feel the Green Party fits in, particularly to LGBT issues.
Yeah, so my kind of key areas of expertise are around welfare, income support, immigration issues, and I've been doing some work around commerce and consumer affairs. I think my proudest achievement was securing residency for around 160,000 migrants through the one of residency pathway, but we've been also busy fighting benefit sanctions, income support, etc. In the rainbow space, my focus last term was on the sports integrity unit. So this was a sort of new body that was created to oversee issues around the well-being of athletes. And I got some of my amendments through, which would guarantee consideration around rainbow representation within that group, which I think is really important, particularly considering the barriers that trans athletes in particular face in sporting bodies.
Yes, we'll come to the latest developments on trans later. I know you also work very closely with Chloe up to the election as you were candidates in nearby seats. One thing that really struck me is that the electorate vote is the one remaining first past the post thing, which, and of course everybody votes differently under first past the post. Mm. Just look at the recent British result, which was mind-blowing. So I was intrigued to know, especially as Mount Albert was your electorate.
Yeah.
Yes. Which was absolute knife edge between National and Labour, whether you got caught up in this wasted vote argument, which is so frequently used in first past the post elections.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question and topic, because what we have here, right, and this is really important for people to consider, is that, you know, the party vote is what determines who gets to be in government. The electorate vote determines who your local representative is, but it actually does not affect which party would end up being in government. In most cases, there may be some exceptions in the Māori electorates where you have this thing called an overhang. So for us, our main priority has always been to campaign for the party vote, but we've always been clear that actually people get the representation that they vote for. And this is why we think it's important that the Greens actually contest electorates seriously. And if we're serious about being the largest party on the left, we have to take the electorate races seriously too. And so we're really proud that we got a three-way race actually in the electorate, and we got our strongest result ever. And I think that's just part of our journey into growing as a party and as a movement. But you're right. We're really lucky that we have the party vote that prevents really distorted results like we've seen in the UK. People actually get a parliament that reflects mostly what people actually voted for.
Yes, I live most of my life in England, and one just got so fed up with the wasted vote argument I mean, for years, that's all that Labour and Conservatives did with the Liberals, just called them a wasted vote. There was never any evidence that the presence or the vote level of a Liberal candidate affected the overall result noticeably. But I just wondered when campaigning for the electorate vote, whether you came across the same issue.
Well, I mean, there were some conversations that we had to have around, for example, like splitting your party vote. Some people may have chosen to do that. You know, we've had people who chose to give their party vote to the Green candidate vote Labour. And we actually had people who did the other way around. You know, we had some people that would have party voted Labour and voted for me as a candidate. But this is why we do need civic education in schools, right? Because MMP, the system that we have, is a good system. It's not perfect, but it is a little bit complicated. And so a lot of the conversations at the door are about explaining our electorate system. And I love those conversations, actually, because I think the more people understand that you can split your vote potentially and or that you can, for example, two-tick Greens, and that actually, if you still want a progressive government, that actually goes a long way towards that. But I still think we have to have more sort of civic education spaces to make sure that people are using their vote in the most effective way possible. The wasted vote argument didn't come massively in the electorate race. I think, if anything, people were more interested about, you know, how are we going to address the cost of living, the climate crisis, housing, access to housing as well.
Yes, the issues don't always get debated very well. Yes, I've followed you a little bit with, especially with immigration. I mean, the Department of Immigration hasn't always had the best track record for making decisions on almost anything. Yeah. My own family have had a small example of that, but I've noticed you have managed to get quite a number of changes. I know you said 3 years ago you would like to work more with National on that when there was a Labour government to take over. Did you ever have any real success in working with other parties on specific issues?
Yeah, well, I mean, we had really constructive conversations around, well, an advocacy that actually got results around ending the automatic discrimination towards people with HIV, which is something that used to happen, where if you had HIV, that basically automatically was like effectively a decline because you were treated as a sort of a high-risk person. But last term I did have some meetings with Erica Stanford as a national representative. It's really interesting how people change once they get access to ministerial powers. And yeah, that has really hampered my ability to, you know, I've extended, I guess, an invitation to Erica to meet to constructively discuss issues. And she did make big promises around the well-being and the rights of migrant workers. But I think now that she's been in power, that kind of tune changed quite a bit.
And she isn't immigration. She's just...
She is. Oh, well, she is as, immigration. Yeah, she
as
is
well
immigration
as education.
Minister now.
My goodness.
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. And I think that's kind of the issue, that immigration has often been treated as a bit of a kind of like hospital pass for ministers, rather than having people who are actually interested on the issue, interested on ensuring we get the policy settings right. And that's a shame, actually, because a huge proportion of our population are migrant workers or people who came via the immigration system. And so I think that means we should have ministers who are neck deep in the community and are aware of the issues that our people face.
You mentioned sort of immigration and HIV. Of course, one very long-running battle we've had in our community is getting a change so that sexually active gay men can actually give blood. And it does seem to be one of the issues where the political has now totally overtaken the health arguments, and our blood donation system is still lagging behind. And I personally get frustrated when they keep saying how short they are of people, because there's no reason now. Do the Greens take that issue up, do you know, still?
Yeah, so, I mean, our Rainbow spokesperson, Benjamin Doyle, I know that they really care about that issue. They've just entered Parliament, but no doubt that will be an area of advocacy. Our position has long been that these rules need to be overhauled to actually follow public health evidence, because right now the blood donation guidelines, when it comes to... particularly, I guess, gay men are really discriminatory, and you know, with all the advances that we have made and the eliminations that we have made when it comes to HIV here in Aotearoa, I think it's preventing a pretty sizable portion of our population from being able to donate blood and save the lives of others.
Yes. I suppose that on that issue, i.e. when the political takes control of what should be a health issue, gets us back to the current situation with transgender youth and puberty blockers. I know you'll be aware of the history, but not all our listeners will. Mm. In the last parliament, there were several bills passed which were of advantage to LGBTI people in general, but often specifically transgender. And it was no coincidence that New Zealand First was not in Parliament at the time, because all the other parties seemed to agree with just one or two issues. Now, of course, New Zealand First is not only back in Parliament, but in the government, and its leader has made very clear, and I feel he is presumably behind the fact that although the Ministry of Health has issued guidelines which seem reasonable, they have also had to have a consultation with all the public, with all their expertise, knowledge on puberty blockers, and that that consultation just closed, hasn't it? And I know the Green Party has been quite vocal in that.
Yeah. So I mean, a couple of things here, right? I think this everything is political, and unfortunately, right now, there's many politicians who are using trans people as the scapegoat. The thing with puberty blockers is that it's worthwhile remembering that it's sort of medical treatment, as healthcare, it has been actually used relatively broadly since the 80s. It just so happens that it's now become a bit of a political football. The key thing that we have heard from frontline organizations is that actually access to gender-affirming healthcare is already quite limited, and that puberty blockers actually should not be further restricted. This is because actually gender-affirming healthcare has a huge impact on someone's well-being, someone's mental health. And I think it's really absurd how when it comes to gender-affirming healthcare for trans people, there's massive, massive, massive misinformation and hysteria whipped up by the right. But actually, it's interesting when we consider all the other gender-affirming healthcare that exists for cis people. I mean, you know, the latest fad is hair transplants, and that actually is a form of gender affirming healthcare. It's a type of healthcare that helps people feel who they want to become. And so, our invitation has been for people to submit, to be grounded on the evidence around puberty blockers, and to listen to the groups that have lived experience who are saying, you know, the evidence doesn't show that restrictions will keep anyone safer. If anything, it risks creating harm and stigma for communities.
Why do you think we've suddenly moved to having a consultation? And what dangers do you think that produces?
Yeah, well, I think you've pointed it out, right? A lot of this is due to the presence of New Zealand First and the government. But I think, to be honest, both the National Party and the ACT Party at different times have pandered to anti-trans rhetoric. I think the sort of submission process is an opportunity for people to channel the energy, but it also opens up the potential for harm to happen. I think all of this kind of submission process it needs to be put into the context, as you've talked about it earlier, that trans people are a scapegoat for the right. There are people going hungry. There's people without housing. There's, people that can't access essential health care. And some politicians would rather keep us distracted on issues that affect trans people. And that's the battleground that we're in, when actually, you know, trans people have existed since humans have existed, and therefore we should look at honoring trans people's rights and their well-being, rather than ending up in this, culture wars that are being stoked and imported, actually, in many ways from the US.
Yes, and Britain, of course, now, with the Cass report. That was one parallel question I wanted to ask you. Notoriously, the Cass report really refused to accept any evidence from the main experts, which is mostly the international organisation called PATH, the Professional Association for Transgender Health. And there's and there's PATHA in New Zealand, which I've seen has of course, submitted. Are you aware of what the attitudes are to the PATH organisation here? Because it appears in Britain, at least, with the Cass report, it was totally sidelined and was seen to be biased and tainted, etc.
Yeah. Well, something that people have highlighted, for example, around the puberty blockers review here is that the government isn't putting enough resources to actually lead that process with trans people and with experts in this area. This is why we can't detach politics from these sort of like neutral reviews and reports, because everything is political. And so, for example, if you stack a review with a bunch of people that have very specific anti-trans sentiments, you're going to get a report that reflects that. But at the same time, I think a lot of these reviews have failed to incorporate A, the groups most impacted by them, in this case, trans people, or the latest available evidence. What I think I find really incongruent is that the coalition agreement from this government has a whole section about following the most available data and evidence. And if they actually did that, they would find that restricting puberty blockers further would go against the latest available data and evidence when it comes to the well-being of our trans rangatahi.
Do you see any hope with the change in the Minister of Health away from the rather conservative minister who voted against the banning of the persuading of young people that they aren't gay or transgender? And I've lost the phrase. Sorry, you were...
No, that's okay. So in regards to the new health minister, Simeon Brown,
yes,
I mean, it's really concerning because not only does he not have any experience in or working on issues and advocacy on health issues, I mean, his whole pre-MP life was quite marked by him just being an anti-abortion advocate. And that is a great example of him going against the evidence around how safe abortion save lives, but also concerning to see a man who campaigned against abortion now being elevated to making decisions around the healthcare system. He's also been quite anti-trans when it comes to, you know, who he chooses to align himself with. What I find some of the most concerning attitudes of any politician going into, you know, dealing on health issues is talking about health as a product, talking about health as if we're consumers, and not health as a sort of system and as a right that people have to access and as a public good. And particularly when so much of our health system is being underfunded, it's an easy distraction to whip up, right? To scapegoat trans people while the core health infrastructure continues to be undermined and underfunded.
What's your feeling of what's going to happen as a result of this, as a result of this consultation? Because lots of consultations, a bit like the Cass report, you know, the answer's there already on a piece of paper, isn't it? And there's a tendency to then skew the evidence and just pick and choose what you want to hear.
Yeah, I mean, look, while I am really heartened that a lot of people have submitted in support of trans people during this process, I also don't have faith that the end product of this review will follow the best available evidence. I think to me that the most important thing we can be doing and our communities can be doing is to keep having conversations with each other on the ground, right? With everyday people who may not be super engaged in the political process. Because I think to me, that's how people who seek to undermine our communities and to scapegoat our communities win, by tapping into the fears that people have about their ability to be well and whipping up, you know, an antagonist. In this case, it's trans people, it may be migrants, it may be Māori, etc. But the most important thing our communities can do, beyond obviously submitting, is to continue talking to their neighbor, to their co-workers, to people at the family dinner, about why supporting our trans community matters. And that's, I think, some of the more kind of powerful things we can do to prevent further harm beyond doing things like submissions.
Yes, thank you. Yes, thank you for that. We've only got a few minutes left. So is there anything else you particularly wanted to inform us and my listeners about?
One of the key focuses for me is around making sure that people who are receiving a benefit are well. And I think one of the key things to note is that there's a lot of new benefit sanctions coming through to punish people on the benefit. I think, you know, one of the key areas I'd love to see changed in the income support space is what we call the relationship rules. And this actually affects a lot of queer people as well. This is when if you become unemployed and your partner is in work, you will unlikely be able to access a benefit because you're deemed as though needing to be supported by your partner. We know this leads to family violence. We know this leads to tensions in the households and financial stress. There's no reason why the state should be forcing someone to be financially dependent from their partner, including when they may not even be married or may have just started dating. So this is a key area to focus on, particularly since unemployment is on the rise.
Well, thank you very much. thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm glad to see you settled into what it seems like quite a senior position in the Green Party. We notice you appearing on TV quite a bit, sometimes with Chloe, but on your own. And
oh well, thank you.
If we get a Labour-led government in the not too distant future, then I hope you manage to get a bit more power as well.
Well, we're working towards that. Yeah.
Fine. Thank you very much again.
Indeed. No worries. Thank you again. Yes. Nice to see you again.
Yes.
Thank you, team.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
The program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.